Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to First Thursday, Labor Relations Information Systems monthly podcast about recent developments in the public safety workplace. My name is Will Aitchison. The next 45 minutes or an hour or so, I'll be taking you through a number of developments that have occurred over the course of the last month. We've got a big, for example, body camera case that came down out of Denver. And there's a California case involving testing for steroids. And I think a very important case out of Maryland, it's a firefighter case involving the Garrity Rule and grand juries. But first, a reminder, and then after the reminder, something a little bit different. We're going to start off 2017 on just of a little bit of a different tone in this podcast. The reminder is that upcoming in February, February 8th through 10th, we are holding our Union Leadership Conference in Las Vegas. This is going to be, I think, a really exciting conference. I don't normally talk much about conferences on these podcasts, but I've just spent hours and hours and hours updating all of the slideshows that will be used in the conference, adding things, subtracting things, making everything generally tighter, and updating things for what's been occurring over the course of the last year. And we've got great panelists, panelists from all over the country, police and fire union leaders who are going to be speaking. And we're going to start off with an hour to 2 hours talking about what we can expect in the next 4 years in the public safety workplace, thanks in large part, although not completely, to the change in presidential administrations. So we look forward to seeing you in Las Vegas, again, February 8th through 10th, and you can register for the seminar or get more information about it at our website, which is LRIS.com. Something else you can find on the website is our Q&A page, question and answer page, and that's how I want to start this podcast. We set that page up so that we can give advice, kind of off-the-cuff advice to people who write in with real-life labor relations problems. Of course, I always have to give the disclaimer that nothing that we say in the answers to those questions should be construed as legal advice. They need to check with local lawyers and all that. But without regard to the fine print, I think it's a pretty good forum for people to ask the sorts of questions that are troubling them and for us to give some pointers as to what might be the right direction. And we had an absolutely fascinating question come in the last month. It's a multi-part question. I'm only going to use one part of it. It comes from the state of Florida, and it's a question that gets asked with some frequency about discipline. Let me read you the question first, and then let's take it apart. Here's the question. I am a municipal police sergeant. I used to be involved more on the labor side of things, but I was recently transferred to an admin position where I find myself having to do more and more management, especially when it comes to discipline. I understand that past practice and consistency are important factors when it comes to assessing discipline. You can't give one person a written reprimand and suspend another for weeks when the offense committed are the same and both have the same employment history. Our union, sometimes very correctly, loves making this argument. However, I've been dealing with what common sense says would be exceptions. Let me give you an example. And here's the example that he sent in. One of our officers got his car stolen by leaving it running and unlocked. Our disciplinary recommendation was a one-day suspension. Very lenient, but he's a decorated officer. Labor union question, what's been the past practice? We had to go back 17 years to find a similar violation through three different chief of police administrations. In that case, the guy who got his car stolen was a favored son and got no discipline. Are we really tied to past practice under these circumstances? It's been 17 years, and a new chief should be able to set his own tone, right? Okay, great question, with a bunch of different sub-questions buried in it. First of all, can a new police chief, new sheriff, new fire chief establish different disciplinary standards? Can you have the new sheriff walk into town and say, I don't really care how it was done in the past. This is how I'm going to do it while I'm here. And the answer is qualifiedly, but a big qualifiedly, yes. Qualifiedly, a new chief administrative officer, chief executive officer for a department can put their own imprint on disciplinary penalties. What are the qualifications? Well, there's two. First of all, under the basic principles of just cause for discipline, one of the key elements of just cause is that you give employees notice. Notice not just as to what is permitted and what is prohibited, but notice of the likely sanctions that might occur if employees violate certain rules. That's thought to be just an element of fairness, that if you tell, for example, an employee, you know, if you do this, let's say it's off-duty driving while intoxicated, you do this, you're going to get a 30-day suspension, that when the employee does that, they get a 30-day suspension. That's thought just to be an element of fairness about just cause for discipline. And the subsidiary idea is that the notice of what might happen if you violate a rule can be given by the employer through the pattern of discipline that it imposes over the years. That's where the notion of past practice comes in. That the employer can convey to employees, sometimes more vividly than through its own rules, what's prohibited, what's permitted, and what the likely sanction is going to be. And that unless the employer tells employees up front, we are changing the penalties for these types of offenses, it would be a violation of just cause to vary from that past practice, at least in a way that's more severe than the past practice would indicate. So that's qualification number one. Qualification number two is the bigger one. Florida, this question comes in from Florida, is a collective bargaining state. There are 32 states in the country with collective bargaining for police, 33 for firefighters. In Idaho, they bargain only for firefighters, or state law exists only for firefighters and not for police. In those states with statewide collective bargaining laws, discipline is almost uniformly thought to be a mandatory subject of bargaining. If you're bargaining under some general bargaining statute that obliges an employer to negotiate over wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment, you can expect that your labor board is going to find that discipline is a mandatory subject of bargaining. And one of the tenets of the obligation to bargain in good faith is that an employer cannot vary from past practice about a mandatory subject of bargaining without first negotiating with the union. So let's go back to our imaginary sheriff striding into town saying, I want to change these disciplinary penalties. Under the principles of just cause, the sheriff can do it so long as he gives notice of what the change is going to be. But if the sheriff is in a collective bargaining state, the sheriff will have to bargain before making the change because discipline is a mandatory subject of bargaining. So that's when I labeled this question, which seemingly seems to be kind of a straightforward one. That's why I said it's a little bit complicated, because employer after employer, they have discovered, and the rules are the same both on the police and fire side here, they have discovered that they can't simply change codes of conduct or disciplinary matrices without first negotiating with the union. I don't know if you remember, about 3 months ago, 4 months ago in the podcast, I went over a Pennsylvania case where a new police chief wanted to throw out the old disciplinary matrix. He felt his hands were tied by the range of penalties that were specified in the matrix. And Pennsylvania's labor board said, well, is discipline a mandatory subject of bargaining? Yeah. Then you have to bargain about it before you throw out the matrix. Any change in disciplinary standards or disciplinary penalties in a collective bargaining state is likely to be mandatory for bargaining. Now let's go back to our Florida sergeant and his question, where the only past practice is 17 years ago under several police chiefs. What's the significance of that? Well, first of all, the several police chiefs part of the question is actually not pertinent. And the reason it's not is the employer, for labor relations purposes, and it's the employer that has the obligation to bargain, the employer is the city or the county. It is not the police chief or the fire chief or the sheriff. So the fact that you may have had one or more police chiefs over the course of the years actually doesn't bear on the bargaining issue. However, can you have a past practice where the only event that occurred was 17 years ago? I actually don't think so. I think you'd be very hard-pressed to find an arbitrator or a court saying that's a consistent past practice. Past practices have to occur with some frequency. And in a disciplinary case, it's hard to say what the bright line would be for that frequency, once a year, twice a year. It's hard to say what the bright line is, but 17 years ago and only once, that doesn't sound like the stuff of which past practices are made to make. So the bottom line answer to this question is, you want to change disciplinary penalties? If you're in a bargaining state, you better be negotiating about it and giving employees notice of whatever the new rules are that come out of the negotiations. And secondly, you're going to need more than a singular occurrence in the last couple of decades to establish a past practice. One final note about the question, I just had to smile a little bit. The author indicates that over the 17 years they had had three police chiefs. That's actually quite a bit of stability in the police chief job classification. The last study I saw on the whole issue suggested that big city police chiefs have an average tenure of 3.1 years, meaning this gentleman would have had 5 to 6 chiefs if he was at the average and not 3. So there must be some stability in that department. Okay, let's talk about some case law. I've got 3 cases I want to talk to you about, and I want to start with the Denver body-worn camera decision that we got out of a district court in Colorado. This is a state-level district court. I have to set the stage a little bit for you on this. There's Colorado is one of these states that has no statewide collective bargaining law for police. It does have one for firefighters. Forgot about that when I recorded the last little segment there. I said that only Idaho had bargaining for fire and not police. Actually, it's Idaho and Colorado. My mistake on that. But there is no statewide bargaining law for police in Colorado. And local jurisdictions, to the extent that they bargain with police unions, bargain under charter or ordinance provisions. And there's a bunch of them that do. And one of the oldest, and maybe even the oldest, is Denver. And Denver City Charter has a general bargaining obligation with respect to Denver's unions, but it's a little bit limited. And one of the areas that it is limited concerns the topics that are negotiable. Rather than having the general statement of negotiability that the city, actually it's a combined city and county in Denver, but I'll call it the city, a general statement that the city has to bargain over wages, hours, and working conditions, in Denver there's a list, a laundry list. You have to bargain over this and that and the other thing. And those are the only things that are thought to be negotiable. And that's why from time to time we'll see some decisions out of Colorado on negotiability that are completely anomalous. They wouldn't obtain anywhere else in the country, and it's because of the constricted nature of the obligation to bargain under Denver's charter. So it's against that backdrop that we have the state trial court considering whether the city was required to bargain over the imposition of a body-worn camera system. The union that represents Denver's police, the Denver Police Protective Association, it typically is called the PPA in Denver, the union made, I think, essentially two basic arguments as to why body cameras were negotiable. And the first argument was that the union contended that body-worn camera systems, or at least the impact of them, fit within the charter's command that the city bargain over hours of work. How? The union's argument, the PPA's argument, was that the use of the cameras could result in an officer working beyond the hours that were required absent body-worn camera systems. And it's kind of well known that the whole process of making sure batteries are charged and images are uploaded and all that sort of stuff takes time. What the PPA was arguing was that the additional work could cause officers to incur overtime, which would, in fact, result in an alteration of the work week. The PPA also pointed to the fact that the new policy would require officers working secondary jobs to wear the cameras as an example of the modification of the work week and hours of work. Court wasn't buying it. The court says, look, hours of work, you know what that means? Hours of work. It means the hours that you are assigned to work. The contract has a very clear definition of hours of work, talks about what shifts are available and the number of hours that are worked in the work week. It doesn't say anything about body-worn cameras in there. And you know what the contract says is important to me because the conduct of the parties before any dispute arose about body-worn cameras is an indication of what they intended the contract to mean, and by extension, what they intend or thought the charter meant with respect to hours of work. And the court ends up saying, I'm not going to give a strained or forced interpretation to hours of work. Body cameras are not hours of work. But, said the court, the PPA makes a second argument here, and this one I think it wins on. The PPA makes the argument that body cams fall within the charter's definition of, and I'm going to quote here, personal health and safety equipment. Why? Why did the court think that a body camera fell within the definition of personal health and safety equipment? And here's what the court said. I'll read you just a couple of sentences because I think they're the highlight of the court's opinion. The court found it was, and I'm quoting, particularly significant that the policy itself highlights a safety dimension to the use of body cameras. Although the policy makes clear that body cameras are intended to serve as an additional means of documenting what goes on in the field, the safety purpose is explicitly included among the five specific uses of body-worn cameras, and in particular, one of those purposes is avoiding potentially confrontational interactions with the members of the public because of the presence of body-worn cameras. So the court ends up saying body cameras are safety equipment. And when I look at the policies, I don't see that the acknowledged safety purpose of body cameras is any more or less important than capturing crimes in progress and documenting police interactions with the public. It all seems to be knit together. And the court says, look, there's an explicit acknowledgement in the policies of the safety implications of body-worn camera systems. And that includes the deterrent effect of a command presence. And the court then gives an example. One need only reflect upon the fact that motorists notoriously become scrupulously observant of speed limits and other traffic laws in those areas of a highway where a police patrol car is visible to recognize the deterrent effect of a command presence. Therefore, says the court, body-worn cameras have a significant safety dimension that is integral to their purpose, and that, even if that purpose is secondary to the evidence-gathering functions of body cameras, the fact that the safety purpose exists qualifies body cameras as personal safety and health equipment within the meaning of the charter. And therefore, says the court, go ye forth and bargain. We're getting some real consistent decisions from around the country now as to whether body camera systems are negotiable. Most of them focus on the disciplinary aspects of body cameras. I've talked about decisions from Oklahoma City and Montgomery County in Maryland. Several decisions in various other places around the country suggesting, because of the disciplinary implications of a body-worn camera system, the imposition of the system is mandatory for bargaining. Denver's the first one to go off on this safety notion, or at least purely on this safety notion. Why? Remember I said that the list of topics that's negotiable under the Denver Charter is limited? Discipline isn't one of them. And the PPA in Denver didn't have that handle to make an argument that because body cameras have some disciplinary implications, they're negotiable. So instead, they focused on safety, and the court says, indeed, body-worn camera systems are pieces of safety equipment that do have to be negotiable. Thus far, every decision that I've read, save one, on body cameras and the negotiability of body cameras, finds that body-worn camera systems are negotiable. The one that's to the contrary is in Hawaii, and that's a case that's currently on appeal through the court system. While I'm talking body cameras, what are we seeing these days on kind of the key question police unions have about body cameras, and that is whether there should be the right to review body camera video before giving a statement? It's kind of hard to tell because most of the evidence here is anecdotal. We have seen some studies. There's one from early 2016 from what's called the Brennan Institute. That's a think tank, a justice think tank. We've also seen some sort of ad hoc assessments by the media, but everything seems in line with the conclusion that the vast majority of departments that have body-worn camera systems either allow or require officers who've been involved in the use of force to review body camera video before giving a statement or writing a report. And by vast majority, I've seen estimates that are higher than 90%. That Brennan Institute study that I referred to said higher than 90%. And some local newspapers that write stories about these things when their police department is implementing a body camera system, when they do their own surveys, they come up with that 90% number as well. That seems to be the trend on the issue. Now I'd like to talk to you about this firefighter Garrity case that comes out of Maryland. It's an anomaly for several reasons. First of all, there are precious few firefighter Garrity cases. Garrity versus New Jersey, of course, the basic case from the U.S. Supreme Court 1966 decision, holding that if a public employee is compelled upon threat of possible job forfeiture to give a statement, if the public employee is told by the employer, talk or you'll be fired, Garrity holds that the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution prohibits the use of the statement or the fruits of the statement in a subsequent criminal prosecution of the employee. Garrity is a rule of immunity, and it's what the courts call the combination of use and derivative use immunity. Can't use the statement, can't use the fruits of the statement to prosecute the employee. And Garrity is, because Garrity itself is a police case, Garrity is sometimes, I think, incorrectly labeled by a bunch of people as involving only police rights. It in fact applies to all public employees, and some of the most important Garrity cases these days do not involve police officers. I can think of one out of California. The main case there is known as Spielbauer, is not a police officer case, and there's a huge case out of Illinois that is not a police officer case. But you just don't see it come up too often in the firefighter context, although, you know, increasingly firefighters are subject to criminal investigations on the job, sometimes associated with the use of drugs, sometimes associated with thefts, sometimes associated with motor vehicle accidents, whatever it might be. And firefighters and fire employers need to understand that Garrity does apply to them, and they ought to be thinking about the Garrity implications of interviews that are done in cases where there's potentially a criminal charge floating around out there. The other reason this Maryland case, and I know you're saying, why don't you just get to the case, but I will in just a second, bear with me. Another reason this Maryland case is somewhat anomalous is it involves a grand jury. Most Garrity cases involve the attempted use of statements at trial after somebody has been indicted or charges have been brought against somebody. This is one that arises in a completely different procedural context. And it results in a decision that, in my judgment, reaches the right result, but has, I think, some really troubling logic behind it. I think some of the logic behind the court's decision was just bluntly wrong, even though the court did end up with the right result. Okay, so what's this case about? There's a grand jury that's meeting, and it issues a subpoena to the Fire and Emergency Medical Services Department of Prince George's County. That's one of the suburban counties to Washington, D.C. And the subpoena asks that the department produce any and all documents related to an assault investigation that occurred in a city called Hyattsville during a fire at the location. And the subpoena wanted videos, dispatch calls, witness and respondent statements, and police reports. Now, the county gets the subpoena and says, whoa, wait a minute, we see some Garrity issues here. And it files with the court a motion for what's called a protective order, asking the court to quash the subpoena because it contained a number of Garrity-related statements. What the county was concerned with is not only were there statements made by firefighters, EMTs, statements made by employees pursuant to orders that they give statements, so clearly Garrity statements. Also, the summary of the investigation referred to the Garrity statements. And at the court hearing, the county explained that this whole thing arose when two career firefighters filed assault charges against two volunteers who were appearing at this fire scene, and that a battalion chief had conducted an investigation and taken a bunch of interviews. The county said, look, about a dozen of the witness statements, including written statements from each of the firefighters involved in the altercation, were compelled under a department policy that required an employee to cooperate with IA investigations or lose their job. The court ends up issuing the protective order, with respect to the compelled statements, but denied the protective order as to videos, dispatch calls, and witness statements. Witness statements, I think what the court meant was third-party witness statements. So in other words, the county in the trial court got Garrity protection for the statements it compelled in its internal affairs process. And that is the issue that goes to what's known as the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. And the court overturns the lower court's doctrine and holds that there are no Garrity protections in this grand jury context for these compelled statements. Why? The court says that Garrity makes clear that it's the, and I'm using the court's words here, extortion of information from the accused that offends our sense of justice. Court goes on to say that the employee can't claim a Fifth Amendment violation based on a grand jury subpoena if the ingredient of personal compulsion against an accused is lacking. Here, says the court, the grand jury isn't compelling the county to speak, nor is it compelling the county to restate or affirm the IA investigator's reports. Instead, the county is merely requesting that the grand jury merely requesting that the county turn over the documents. And the court ends up saying, consequently, the county's act of producing those documents would be non-testimonial and therefore would not implicate the Fifth Amendment privilege. But, you know, we get a lot of training when we go to law school about reading cases and respecting courts and all of that sort of stuff. And it's with that background and you know, every bit of reverence I can muster that I say that what I just read to you from the court's opinion is utter garbage, right? And it's utter garbage because the statements were compelled by the county. The moment they were compelled, immunity attached to those statements. There's case after case after case that holds that the moment that an employee is given an order that they must answer questions or be subject to potential termination, that's the moment that the Fifth Amendment springs to life and confers immunity on the statements. The fact that it is the county turning over the statements to the grand jury rather than the employee being subpoenaed into the grand jury shouldn't matter one bit at all. The statements are still covered by Garrity, and they do, contrary to what the court held, implicate the Fifth Amendment. Okay, so I think the rationale of the court here is absolutely wrong. But I do think the result is right. And the result meaning that the trial court should not have issued a subpoena, quashed the issuance of the subpoena. Why do I think that's right? Because the remedy for the Fifth Amendment violation is suppression of the statements. And suppression only occurs when you have charges that are eventually brought against employees. There's no suppression process that exists in a grand jury, at least not one that I know about. Instead, where you find motions dealing with Garrity, you find them in the trial court after somebody has been indicted. And that is, in fact, very much what would likely happen here. And if, in fact, the grand jury brought back charges against anybody, I would expect that there'd be a motion to suppress in the trial court all of the statements that were made pursuant to Garrity, at least by the accused. But there's something else that really concerns me about the implications of this court's opinion. And that is that it might end up leading prosecutors down a wrong path. And what's that wrong path? The wrong path is in thinking that you can use compelled statements under Garrity to get an indictment. And so long as you don't use them in trial, you're home free. And in fact, there's a ton of case law precisely to the contrary. Big case out of Ohio about 6 years ago, 7 years ago. Name is State versus Jackson. We can send you the citation if you're interested. The Garrity violation that resulted in the dismissal of all charges against a police officer was that the prosecutor merely read the internal affairs file while in the grand jury process. The internal affairs file wasn't even submitted to the grand jury. The prosecutor merely read it. And the court, this was the Ohio Supreme Court, concluded that that's impermissible use of compelled statements that violate Garrity. Why? Because when you read the compelled statement, you get information you otherwise wouldn't have, but for the fact that this is a public employee. You get statements like, what is the defendant's alibi? Who are the defendant's witnesses? What physical evidence is the defendant relying upon? What other defenses might the defendant have? You get all that information. You get an advantage. And the fact that you got that advantage because you used the thing in the grand jury process doesn't mean you're home free if you don't use it in the trial process. You have tainted it forever. So that's the broadest thing that concerns me about this court's opinion is that it seems to be suggesting to prosecutors, hey, okay, go ahead, use this stuff in the grand jury, so long as you don't use it in trial. I think that rationale is completely wrong. So my judgment on this case, wrong thinking, probably the right result, but wrong thinking by the court. The last case I want to talk about is one that comes out of Los Angeles County, and it involves steroids. We don't have too many drug testing steroid cases out there, which is why I want to talk about this one a little bit. I think the opinion of the court here, it comes from the California Court of Appeals, has some really good analysis of the whole drug testing process with respect to steroids. Just a little bit by way of history here, when many public sector drug testing policies were adopted, you know, when it was all the rage back in the 1980s, they didn't even test for steroids. It just wasn't really much of an issue. And many drug testing policies today still don't test for steroids. Of course, if you're going to change what you test for, that's probably a negotiable event in a bargaining state. That may be why we haven't seen a rush to testing for steroids. But Los Angeles County is one employer that does, in fact, test for steroids. And this case, I think, illustrates some of the pitfalls of how you go about testing for steroids. So what's it about? It involves a guy named Richard Orozco, who was a Los Angeles County deputy from 2001 to 2008 when he was terminated. And this is the case that challenges his termination. This all starts in the previous year before he was terminated in September 2007. Orozco lives in Long Beach in Los Angeles County, and the Long Beach Police Department gets a domestic violence call to his house where he lived with his girlfriend, Veronica Hernandez. The officers end up deciding that Hernandez was the aggressor, and they arrest her, and their police report contains her statement that Orozco was taking illegal steroids to enhance his physique. Roscoe, following his own employer's policies, reports himself. He reports the incident to his supervisor in Los Angeles County. Several weeks later, the sheriff's department, finishes processing a prior case involving Roscoe. He got a 15-day suspension for a prior incident where he tried to work a third shift at the end of two consecutive shifts. And when he was told that he couldn't work three consecutive shifts, he behaved in a threatening and hostile manner towards his supervisor. For that, he got 15 days. And when he comes back from his suspension, he gets ordered by his lieutenant to take a for-cause urine test because the department announced it had reasonable suspicion that he was using steroids. Court doesn't get into that, by the way, whether or not Roscoe's situation presented enough in the way of reasonable suspicion. I think it did. I think the report that he had been consuming steroids and his behaving in a threatening and hostile manner combined, I think, meets the threshold for reasonable suspicion. Remember, reasonable suspicion is a lighter standard than probable cause. So, at any rate, the department gets a urine sample and sends it to an outfit known as Quest Diagnostics for a steroid panel. And it's at this point that you need to understand something just basic about steroids. And I'm going to veer a little bit into the medical here, which means I'm going to get everything I'm about to say wrong, but just bear with me. There are two kinds of steroids. Exogenous steroids. Exogenous steroids are not naturally produced by the body. And there are endogenous steroids, which are naturally produced by the body. Three of the more common exogenous, meaning we don't produce them, steroids are boldenone, nandrolone, and drostanolone, which I thoroughly botched the pronunciation of. They're all exogenous steroids, meaning they're produced somewhere outside of our bodies. And in order to test for these three steroids, laboratories, including Quest Diagnostics, they can't find the steroids, they look for metabolites, steroid metabolites in the urine. And they found all three in Roscoe's urine. So the department cranks up an internal affairs investigation. In it, Roscoe denies using steroids, but he said he did use over-the-counter dietary supplements. And Roscoe said, hey, it's those supplements that explain the presence of the steroid metabolites in my urine. He provided the department with a partial list of the supplements that he used. I'm going to read you this partial list, and it only makes me wonder what the complete list had to look like. Here's the partial list. AH89, VNS9, Tren Extreme, BRN2 Extreme, TT40 Extreme, HGMG Extreme, Methyl-1D, 5D Stack, Equidern, Decanor 50, Test Suspension, looks like Uthafon, Nitrate, NO Explode, Nitrex, Lipodrine, and Isopure Protein. Oh my. At any rate, the department ends up deciding that Roscoe lied during the IA investigation and had in fact been using steroids. It goes to a 6-day hearing before an administrative law judge, a hearings officer, and he issues a 56-page report, and he recommends reinstatement. In his judgment, the ALJ says the positive test for metabolites could well have been the result of these dietary supplements that Roscoe was taking. And the department didn't meet its burden of proof that these were steroid metabolites produced by the use of illegal steroids. The ALJ also concludes that since the department didn't show that Roscoe was using steroids, Therefore, it couldn't show that he made false statements to investigators about whether he was using steroids, and he recommends reinstatement with back pay. There's a hearing before the County Civil Service Commission. Initially, the Civil Service Commission seems inclined to upholding the ALJ's decision, but eventually, by a 3-2 margin, overturns the hearing officer's conclusions and terminates Orozco. And the Civil Service Commission finds that Orozco, in fact, was taking steroids and lied about it. Orozco then challenges that, goes to a trial court. Trial court overturns Civil Service, reinstates the hearing officer, and reinstates Orozco. The county then challenges the trial court up in the Court of Appeals, and the county loses. The court ends up focusing on the extensive hearing before the administrative law judge and says, look, in these sorts of cases where we're hearing appeals through the civil service process, we're going to rely a lot on fact finders who are there to observe the witnesses and evaluate the credibility of the witnesses. The court in particular criticized the county for overstating the test results. The court said, according to the county's own expert, get this guy's name, Dr. Sample. Dr. Sample is the drug testing expert. You just gotta love it. You can't make this up. So according to its own expert, Dr. Sample, a laboratory tests a subject's urine for metabolites, but a positive result, according to Dr. Sample, doesn't establish whether the subject was using either illegal steroids or over-the-counter supplements. Either, according to the doctor, can produce a positive result. That means, says the court, that Orozco's positive test results didn't eliminate the use of over-the-counter supplements as a causal agent. And I'm going to read to you from the court's opinion here. Here's the bottom line. Consistent with Dr. Sample's testimony that the test results were suggestive that Orozco had consumed either steroids or precursors, the trial court found that the test results were insufficient to prove the charge of illegal steroid use. And here, Orozco has consistently denied the use of all steroids. He's asserted this causal link between supplements and the positive results, and the county's own doctor found a potential causal link. Reinstate him with back pay. Oh my, 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 my. Back pay since 2008. 8 years of back pay. That's a pretty amazing result. So, at any rate, this falls in line, I think, with the few steroid cases that we have, that if you are going to discipline somebody for a positive test result for steroids, you better make sure that you deal with the supplement question in great detail and specifically. Perhaps what you do in your policy is you ban the taking of certain over-the-counter supplements that will mimic steroid metabolites in a person's urine. I've seen many drug testing policies that do precisely that. But if you don't handle the issue of supplements carefully, you're going to end up with a result that is very much like this. Okay, that's it on the cases. I did want to spend just a moment talking about where we are in terms of wage settlements for police and fire around the country. We try to track these at LRIS. We do it just through newspaper articles, so we're hopeful that any errors in those articles kind of even out over the mass of them that we do. We print those results, by the way, in our monthly newsletter, Public Safety Labor News, which you can pick up through LRIS's webpage. And in 2016, we saw wage increases that averaged about 2.5% for law enforcement officers across the country. And that means both deputy sheriffs and police officers. The wage increases for firefighters, a little bit less, about 2.1%. And that continues a trend that we've seen for 3-4 years. And it's a trend that no doubt has its roots in the law enforcement hiring crisis that is out there. And as of course, if the labor pool shrinks, which it definitely has for law enforcement officers, in order to attract people for the job, you're going to have to pay more money. Hence, I think, the differential between police and fire wages. So if you're interested in specific wage settlements or in these overall trends that we're seeing, again, check out our newsletter. So with that, that's our first podcast of 2017. I'll be back in early February of 2017. I guess I can stop saying 2017 now. And I will no doubt be talking about what we are seeing from the first days of the Trump administration with respect to labor relations issues and public safety. With that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.